We are in business now. You should see my slides. Yes?
Awesome. Yeah.
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. I haven't done a whole lot on meetups.
So. Yeah, we like free. So free is good. Yeah.
Free is always good. I hear you.
I started using Zoom. I paid for my monthly fee for Zoom, and then they failed me because I invited 100 people and only 50 people got in. So.
Oh, that's painful.
You're so fired.
Yeah, like yeah.
$14.99 a month, you know?
You know, it's amazing how these platforms have exploded since COVID and everybody's doing this sort of thing. I'm doing a talk, let's see, next week. That's actually another platform that has a Zoom integration. So I log into one place, then it spawns off a Zoom meeting off to the side and channels the audio back into the web platform. It's amazing to me how creative they're getting with some of these online platforms right now.
Yeah, I know Zoom is loving it at this point, though. They were so busy they didn't have time to answer my support question. They wrote back and said that, oh, due to COVID, we don't have time to answer it yet.
Well, and they exploded. Then they got all this attention on them for of these other things, right? And, you know, when companies hit hypergrowth like that, it can be a bad thing. It can actually be a really bad thing. And they kind of felt a little bit of that pain.
Minor security issues.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, and so many of these, though, are still how they're set up, how the meetings are set up, you know, so like, I'm here in Tampa where that wonderful young man pulled off that Twitter thing from, right? And so his Twitter hearing was being done on Zoom. So here we have a hacker having a Twitter hearing on Zoom and it's not password protected, right? So then obviously shenanigans happen. Wow. And you know, and the line from the judge I thought was kind of funny, and he just said, you know, I really didn't want to have to do this, but I think we're going to have to password protect these meetings. I'm just like, that might be a good idea to do that in the first place, you know?
Why was that an afterthought?
Right. You know, these are only hearings for people. I mean, what sensitive information could possibly get tossed around when somebody is facing accusations, right?
That's so crazy. All right. So it looks like we have quite a quorum here. Dr. Picard, did you want to introduce Eric more formally to the group now?
Sure. So hi, everybody. So I'd like to thank you, Tina, for organizing this meeting. Thank you, Eric, for accepting our invite. So Eric, those are some of my students from cybersecurity classes. You know, I'm trying to bring in a bunch of people so that they find out that there are careers, that it's interesting jobs, that there's money. These are pretty much some of my goals, okay? So I want students, at the end of the day, you know, there's no specific format for today. It's really them hearing from different types of practitioners. There was General Petraeus that said a bunch of things. There was Chris Roberts that said other things. I want to bring them different perspectives so that they realize that there are careers, there's money, and certifications. So I invited Eric because Eric worked with me. He's a former cybersecurity manager for the U.S. Army. He was responsible for 250,000 devices, which is quite impressive. That's 250,000 routers, switches, and things of that nature. Afterwards, he went to the dark side and he started working for commercial. He worked for ISC Square. What was your role at ISC Square?
I was the director of member relations and services there. So here's my little bio slide here.
And then he started working with Kevin Mitnick, and he currently works for Known Before as a cybersecurity evangelist. Is that correct, Eric? Did I cover most of it?
Yeah, that pretty much covers it. Yeah, so absolutely. You know, I've been in the industry. Gosh, I started in IT and then moved my way up into security throughout the years, just kind of moved that direction. Actually, I started the real push into that, Laurent, when we worked together in the Army there on the emerging technology team, doing the testing of systems that were coming in from organizations that were attempting to engineer things. And I'm saying that kindly. Yes, Laurent. And then putting them into practice. And one of the things I enjoyed doing with that was some of the security testing. So that kind of got me interested in this. I'd done obviously security as part of a role all throughout my IT career. So I started in 95, I think, and I was managing firewalls and accounts and all of these things that used to be kind of the hat of any IT guy. We handled all this stuff, but as IT has exploded, the roles that we play and the different things that we're doing now, they're just too much for one person to do them all. So it became much, much more kind of like focused, right? There's niches all over the place. Now, one of the niches that I play in that I absolutely positively love is the one we're going to talk about today, and that is social engineering. I love it. I absolutely love it. Y'all are going to be so lucky to see Aleith Dennis in a future one as well.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Aleith is amazing. I watched her over at DEF CON win the social engineering capture the flag. She is an amazing, amazing lady, and her and I have become a bit of friends, you know, at the different conferences and stuff. You guys will be honored and love seeing what she's doing. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the practices that we all use in social engineering. Now, if you've heard of Kevin Mitnick, Kevin is very well known for social engineering. He's also known for being put in jail for it and done a lot of time, kind of played games with the FBI. And he has redeemed himself at this point. It was a very interesting time in the cyber world where laws and kind of where you push the limits of things were still being written. And he never stole money. He was always just getting access. And he did it through phone calls a lot of times. Now, phone calls, believe it or not, are incredibly, incredibly good at getting people to give up information, even to this day, which is a little bit shocking. You think, oh, we're in 2020 now. We should have a handle on this. Here's a little, no, we don't, honestly. So we're going to talk about these things today. I want to talk about open source intelligence. That's OSINT. Social engineering, how they gather data and all that. And then I just wanted to be open for people to ask questions. Again, I've been in the industry a long time. I've actually worked in medical, manufacturing, of course, the DoD, as we discussed. Let's see, ISC squared. I've been in all kinds of industries. I was with an MSP or managed service provider for a while. So I'm happy to talk about any of that if you're wondering how this all plays into things. So having said that, we'll move on to this and get through some of the slides here. I think these are going to be fun. Please feel free to ask questions as well. I'll try to keep an eye on chat. Not going to deny sometimes I miss that. So we'll see what happens. I'm playing back and forth between two screens. So anyways, OSINT. What is OSINT? It's open source intelligence. Okay. It's pretty interesting. OSINT is... it's getting information from public sources. And, you know, believe it or not, there are so many public sources to get this information from. We are leaving a digital footprint everywhere we go. And so what's happened is the bad guys have gotten really, really good at doing that. Using social media profiles. Now, the thing about open source intelligence is this is not private information. That's the difference. It's open source. In other words, it is out there for the public. So don't think about this as the kind of data that they get from breaches or on the dark web or anything like that. This is Facebook, LinkedIn. This is all of those kinds of things that we don't even think about. If you think about it, we use OSINT for good as well as evil, right? We use it when, let's say we want to get a new job. We're going to research the organization we're going to go to. And we're going to look things up. We're going to go to LinkedIn. We're going to see who the bosses are. I mean, at least I hope you are. This is a great thing to do if you're doing this. We use it for good, not just evil. But there's a lot of stuff out there that they can use for evil. If you're in a not-for-profit, there are tax forms that you have to file that give your kind of your key vendors that you deal with, the key people in your organization, members of the board, all that stuff is public information that is very easy to get and then turn around and use against people. So how are these tied together? Well, what they'll do is they'll gather information about targets. They're looking at hobbies. They're looking at political affiliations, right? Physical location, family members, all that kind of good stuff. So you build a story of these people and you use this information for a pretext. So the pretext is essentially, let's say I'm going to make a phone call. The pretext is the story, the persona that I'm building. So let's say this is a person who has, you know, a kid in elementary school, and I have no idea how that zoomed. That was kind of cool. I didn't know it did that. But I have a kid that's in elementary school. I'm going to target these people that have a kid in elementary school. I may call up and say, hey, this is so-and-so. I'm with, you know, I'm the nurse at the school. Your kid's having such and such a problem, so on and so forth. And I might try to get them to give me information about that kid. You know, I just want to confirm their age. Okay, cool. You know, and da-da-da-da-da. You can just start getting information about people. There's also ways, you know, we saw this in California a couple of years ago. I haven't seen it much anymore, but people were finding out on social media where these kids went to school because it's all posted on Facebook and all that good stuff. And then what they would do is they figure out what time school starts and look around a map. There's all this stuff is available, and they would call them up and say, you know, we grabbed little Johnny on his way to school. And if you don't pay us in the next 1 hour, you'll never see little Johnny again. And so they were actually extorting people using the information that they found on that. And these parents, you know, it was, if you call the police, you know, you're done for, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea was to get them to pay this. In the meantime, little Johnny, he's fat, dumb, and happy at school, enjoying lunch, and, you know, nothing's going on. But they used that public information to form these sorts of attacks. Now, me being a security guy and in social engineering, part of me cringes when I see those stickers on the back of the window, like, you know, so-and-so dance school, and then the kid's name underneath, right? Now, I try not to live in this tinfoil hat world, but it's one of those things that we look at and we have to understand that there are risks to putting that stuff out there, okay? Another thing that happens is we have in our organizations, let's say, like, I'll tell you right now, our CEO, Stu Showerman, great guy. He donated $1 million of his own dollars to the local Humane Society last year, just to help out. He loves doing stuff like that. So let's say I want to set up for wire transfer fraud. I know this about him. I've seen the press release on it or the news story, rather. I don't think they did a press release, but I'm going to call up and I'm going to call maybe accounting, or I'm going to send an email to accounting, and I'm going to say, you know, I'm going to make it look like it came from Stu, and I'm going to say, hey, COVID is really hitting the animal shelter really bad right now. I need you to wire 50K to this place right now. They lost some sponsors. The dogs are going to starve. I want to take care of it. I'll take care of the paperwork when I get back in the office tonight. I'm in a meeting with these folks, want to get back to it, right? Now, the people that receive that know that he's an animal lover, right? And so it makes them more likely to believe the story. This is where open source intelligence and social engineering really come together. And you see organizations that do this on the About Me pages for their organizations, because we're trying to build personal connections to leadership sometimes in organizations. So they give all this great information about their hobbies and stuff too. Now, political is another one. You may or may not have noticed we have kind of a significant political divide in the country lately. And those topics get people very upset. And we'll talk about this in a minute here. But social engineering works on emotional responses, and that is a fantastic way to do it. So if you find that somebody's a donor or something like that to a certain political party, you know they're more engaged in that than, say, the typical person that just votes one side or another. And that's another lever. So those are some examples of how OSINT and social engineering can be worked together. So let's talk a little bit about, yeah, go ahead.
Can I stop you for a second? Mention a few examples, Eric, if you don't mind. As some of you may have noticed, I posted on LinkedIn about the individuals that I invited. And what's very interesting to me is that I got invited from half a dozen people from Middle Eastern countries and from Russia and from China. Who are very interested by our conversations. And, you know, it's, you know, there has been a number of things that have been posted that said that right now North Korea is focusing a lot on LinkedIn to try to gain information to pretty much hurt us as a country. So, you know, plenty of examples of this. Also, you can, if you use LinkedIn and you accept a re-invitation, be careful, because depending on what's inside, there are people that will put fake pictures, especially young women, for example. There will be nice pictures trying to attract dumb guys pretty much. And the job descriptions will be pretty much empty. They're just trying to collect names, collect information, and use it.
Yep, absolutely. You know, LinkedIn is a great source for this, and we'll talk a little bit about this here. But that's true. You know, we have a lot of what happens out there, especially around finances, is cybercrime gangs. There are actually large, very organized groups that specialize in certain things, especially around ransomware and some of that malware stuff. But then you have the nation states, and each of them has a little bit different playbook. And they do things a little bit differently. Like Russia is very much about trying to cause division right now. A lot of what you see on Facebook and Twitter, especially the political stuff, is actually coming from Russian bots. There's been some studies about how significant this sort of thing is happening. Now, China and you know, when you get into like North Korea and Iran, a lot of times they're actually after money. They'll do financial attacks because they're under such hard sanctions from us and from other countries that finances are difficult for them to do. So they tend to be very monetary in their attacks. There's just different playbooks from different groups. But I'll tell you this, they're all very, very good. Even down to the ransomware gangs and stuff like that, these folks are really, really good. And they are experts at getting this data. So there's tools out there. Now, this was called Buscador. It's not really being maintained anymore. It was from Intel Techniques. It's really cool, but this gives you an idea of some of the tools. If you've heard of like Kali Linux or you know, Backtrack, used to be Backtrack, it's a distribution with all of these tools to go do attacks. Now, this is one that's designed entirely to gather information on people. So as these tools are being perfected, they're designed to go out there and start piecing together different profiles, find out information, and basically build a dossier on somebody very, very quickly and in an automated fashion. So I wanted to put this in here so you understand, this is more than just individuals bouncing around out there doing stuff. There are actually a number of purpose-built tools that are being used in these attacks. That's how developed we're getting with open source intelligence. Now, I love this picture here. And information is the key to a successful attack. This is the social engineering village with Chris Hadnagy and the gang here. When you hear from Aleith, she sat in that booth and started calling companies and getting points for information she was able to get out there. So you understand, this is a photo of the social engineering capture the flag, it's called, at DEF CON.
She was phenomenal. I saw her, it was phenomenal. I mean, she was getting guys to talk and give her every single information she was asking for.
Yep, and the key to this is, though, building the pretext and doing some research up front. When they do all of this research, figure out what they're going to ask, how they're going to pose themselves in certain areas. That's the key to winning these sorts of things, just like the bad guys use it. It's pretty crazy. So using the information to attack, let's move into this here real quick. First of all, we have to understand this. All humans are vulnerable. And I love this quote. I've never found it hard to hack most people. If you listen to them, watch them, their vulnerabilities are like a neon sign screwed into their heads. This was from Mr. Robot. And if you haven't seen it, Mr. Robot is a pretty cool show through like season one and two. And then it kind of jumped the shark, in my opinion. We can argue about that later. But it kind of went downhill after that. But the first two seasons I really liked. And what I liked about it, though, is it used real attacks. You know, you see like, you know, these shows on network TV, you know, where they come in like what, CSI Cyber, and the guy comes in, of course, flips up the hoodie, you know, starts banging away at the keyboard for 30 seconds and then says something like, I'm through the firewall. You know, we know that that's not real at all. This uses real social engineering techniques and real tools, including like Dave Kennedy's social engineering toolkit. things like that in order to attack humans. And that's a lot of their attacks. And this is really what happens. We know that about 91% of breaches start with the spear phishing attack, whether it's information gathering or something along those lines, and we are vulnerable. There are certain ways that we act as people, and this is what social engineering does, certain ways we act, and we can take advantage of that. And one thing that I love, and we're going to do something a lot of fun here, I love, you know, magic, and magic is actually a social engineering trick most of the time. So we're going to start out here real quick. I want to show you how this works. All right. You guys ready for a magic trick? Here we go. I want you to pick a card, pick any of these cards right here. I'm going to make your card disappear. So pick a card, have it in your mind. Everyone has it in their mind. And here's where the magic actually is. It's the PowerPoint transition that actually performs the magic here. Really? Okay. Is your card gone? Right? Everybody should be nodding at this point. Your card is gone. So how did I do this in a presentation, in a PowerPoint over, you know, Google Hangouts? Some of you may know the answer to this, right? But
different cards. It's not the same ones.
Exactly. We start with this deck right here. And what we do is we end with this group of cards right here. And so they're completely different. Now, this is a form of focus redirection. So what you're going to do is you're going to get that person focused on the card you're going to remove. And so they're focused on that, focused on that, focused on that. They don't notice the other cards around there. They're not trying to memorize the other cards in the group. So then you replace it with something similar. And you'll notice the replacement cards are in a similar color pattern, right? Red kings, black queens, et cetera, et cetera. That's designed to further that. Now, if the second group there was 2 through 10s, boom, you'd know immediately, right? But this is one of our vulnerabilities. Our brains do funny things. And we think we can focus on a lot of stuff, but we can't. Now, I'll tell you, if you've ever seen it, there's a series out there called Brain Games, which is absolutely awesome. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
It really kind of shows you things that you have no idea that your brain is doing. And the fact is, our brains, they are the root of the deception, right? It's because our brains filter things we don't think about. Okay. So we know that what we smell, what we hear, what we taste, all of that stuff, right? We're just sure that's reality, but it's not. It's actually our brains doing some filtering in these things. Now, for example, if you just take your eyes and look left and then look right out of the side of your head here, you know, if you look up, look down, odds are you probably didn't notice your nose, right? Why is that? Because your brain actually filters your nose out of your vision most of the time. It's an amazing thing. So if we can take advantage of these little vulnerabilities that we don't even know of, that's where this stuff comes in. So what we're going to talk about here is the principles a lot of these groups use, from, you know, magicians to con artists to whatever.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Absolutely.
Eric? Can I mention, when we were at DEF CON 3 years ago together, and there was, I think it was just after the thing that you just mentioned a second ago about social engineering, there was a guy that was a former hard rock band member. Do you remember that guy?
Barely, but yes.
But he said something that was very interesting to me. Is that you can trick people to react a certain way based on music. And they had run an experiment where you play some hard rock music, number one, then you play the Beach Boys, and then you put Frank Sinatra My Way. By the time you put Frank Sinatra My Way, most people are going to be depressed. And you can trigger, actually, by playing with the pattern of the music into people's brain to condition them going from an up to a down and potentially get depressed. And you can use it potentially for adversarial purposes. Do you have any experience with this?
I haven't. I just don't remember what band he was with. But yeah, he was a very popular rock singer. And yeah, I don't remember who he was. It was someone, Chris Hadnagy, I knew, I think. But yeah, it was interesting talking about how that influences us.
Who invited him?
I believe it was Chris Hadnagy that had him up there, who runs the social engineering capture the flag sort of stuff. Okay. Now, the thing is, our emotions are in many ways a release of different pheromones and hormones and all kinds of weird stuff in our bloodstreams actually helps us feel these emotions. And this is why it's a vulnerability for us. If we can figure out how we're going to drive somebody a certain direction, like you mentioned, if we can do music that they may not even notice, but it brings them in a calm state, we may be able to take advantage of that. But for somebody else, we may want to get them in an agitated state and then take advantage of that. And those are all great ways to deal with the emotional part. And music definitely handles emotions. And that's kind of like what I'm about to talk about here. This is called the OODA loop. And you may learn about this in business as well. The OODA loop is these four steps: observe, orient, decide, and act. And this is kind of how it works. Let's say I'm somewhere and I look at a room and I'm observing the room. I'm seeing what's out there, seeing what the room looks like. I'm going to orient myself there. So, okay, I'm at this point in the room. I would like to be in this point of the room. Okay, so that's my orienting. Let's say I want to be 2 feet to the right of where I am right now so that I can see other people. So now I make the decision. How am I going to do this? Well, I'm going to take two physical steps to the right. That's my decision. Then I'm going to act. I'm actually going to do it. Now I go back into the loop and I look at the room again. Okay. And I say, this is where I want to see. I orient myself, etc. It's just a big loop. It's a decision process that we end up doing here. And it's very interesting. If you haven't seen this, it is used in business situations. It was also created initially for aviation combat, where people have to be making these decisions very quickly. And the ideal situation for this is for the social engineer to hijack this loop. And the way this works is the first three steps there, observe, orient, and decide, are critical thinking steps. So if we can overpower those with somebody that something that makes people emotional, if you've ever been very emotional, how hard is it to make good decisions during that time? They tend to be rash decisions. And this is like we talked about with the music just now, somewhere that somebody could use these outside influences to even further influence these areas here emotionally and get you to fail at one of these steps. If you can mess with any of these three steps, you're going to affect the action that comes from it. And this is the key to the way that these attackers do this. It's a fascinating process. There's whole books on this, on this whole OODA loop thing, but it is pretty fascinating. But this is the thought process. So again, we're trying to hit those first couple of deals there. Now, moving into this Twitter thing, right? I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about this in a social engineering talk. This was basically a guy called him up, got some numbers, called him up, and said, this is the IT department, need your password. And somebody at Twitter gave it up, and this somebody at Twitter had the permissions to go in through this platform and impact all of these, you know, these different accounts. Now, frankly, in my mind, the kid was kind of a fool to only make $100,000 off of this. The potential was so much greater. And if you think about it, people would have paid a lot more than that just to be able to have access to that on the dark web, the bad guys. You know, they had influencer accounts from Apple, the official Apple account, you know, and everything in between. This was a very basic pretext. This is one that we even have set up in our platform to do robocalls for. It's been working for years. It continues to work. And it's unfortunate, but this was a very simple way to do that. Now, this was a huge company. You'd think they'd be prepared for it. This is something that I just got the other day. So my wife and I this year, we started an LLC. I do laser engraving and stuff on the side. Well, when you file an LLC, you have to put a lot of information out there. It's your names, your address, which is why we use a PO box that we purchase, phone numbers, contact information for all the people that are in there. It's all out there. So what happens now is phone calls like this. This was supposedly came in from Michelle in the Education and Compliance Outreach Department of the Florida Department of Revenue. Okay, so is there a department like that? Not according to Google. And the phone number was coming from Texas. You know, this is kind of weird. Small organizations even are being targeted like this. Now, what they're going to do is if I was to call this person back, they're going to ask me to confirm my information, things like my social security number and all of that kind of sensitive stuff, as much as they can possibly get from you. Now, it's very smooth. They're very, very good at doing this. But because I'm aware of these and I'm naturally a paranoid person, I realized pretty quickly that this was all a scam here. There are a lot of things like this that happened large and small. But again, this was public information, much like when you buy a car, or if, heaven forbid, you've ever bought a house, the letters you get afterwards of everyone trying to sell you things is incredible, because they actually sell off these lists of that information. That's more places where they'll do that. Now, the bad guys will do that as well.
Eric, can I mention that in Ohio, if you buy a house, your social security is actually visible on the county auditor website. Anyone that searches for someone's house will see the owner of the house social security number.
And see, bigger issue, social security numbers were never really meant to be an identification number that's used in all of the different ways that we've ended up kind of twisting it into being used. And it's unfortunate, but you know, it's the world we live in. And yeah, it's out there in a lot of different places. And it's kind of scary. All you can do is take steps to try to protect as much as you can. But you know, they get this information and it makes them very easy, makes it very easy to come after you. Now, what we noticed is as COVID hit, it didn't slow these folks down. As a matter of fact, they really ramped it up. And I thought this was really interesting. This was the first couple of weeks, and I cannot read this right now. What I do know is the first week there, and I think it was March 8th through something there, I believe there were 16 brand new phishing templates that we saw. So what that means is the bad guys have had to do work. And let me tell you, they don't like doing work. So it was 16, March 8th through March 14th. They created 16 brand new templates to attack people around COVID. The next week it was 36, okay? Again, this is very unusual to see brand new templates. And the next week it was 94. Google said at one point they were blocking 18 million COVID-19 related scam or phishing emails every day out of the 100 million that they block. So that's about 20%, almost 18%. That's a huge number. And so the folks, they jump on this. Anytime there's a natural disaster, a man-made disaster, or anything like that, they jump on it and they make some of these templates. And I pulled a couple of these together because I wanted to show you some of these. This is one that we saw. This was about the stimulus bill. So our government went around and they said, we're going to do a stimulus bill and you'll have money coming your way. And there was a lot of ambiguity as to how this was going to work, right? Everyone was excited and had no idea how this was going to play out. Imagine you've lost your job. You're in the situation that this is very important. So what they did is they turned around and they used this as a way to get people to do that. So here we go. It's supposed to be from American Express, telling you that they need you to confirm things. Well, they're going to confirm your bank account information, which is probably not one of those things you want to give to the bad guys, right? It was really, really crazy. This one actually ended up going to a Google Doc, which American Express is probably not going to have something on docs.google.com confirming your information. But this was a very interesting method to do this. And this was because of the unknowns that were around that. Now, the next one here, I love this one. This was supposed to be from the VP of the US, right? So Mike Pence. And it was going after business owners. And this was an interesting angle here. It was basically saying, you've done all these bad things and you need to get a hold of us. What was unique about this is there was no link in this. This was solely designed to open up a communication channel with the person. And the way these usually work is, well, if you promise not to do it again and pay us this fee or fine, probably in like iTunes gift cards or something stupid, then we'll let it all go, right? That's the scam here. But it's actually designed just to get the conversation going. Now, I love these things that I see. I absolutely love it. I'm seeing some comments roll in here. I love Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States. Just one of them, folks. the stuff that floats around in these, sometimes the English in these is very, very poor, but sometimes it's actually very, very good. And there are actually services on the dark web where you can hire groups that will take the phishing attack that you want to put out there, and they will actually correct your grammar. They will correct your spelling, and they guarantee an improved click rate based on the services they provide. It's a whole underground economy around phishing, and it's kind of mind blowing. And to give you an idea, last time I checked, to send 50,000 emails like this to people was $65. So you can see if they just get one person, they've made their money back, right? This is a very lucrative business for these folks, and it's very, very cheap to do this. When it comes to ransomware is even worse. A lot of times that works on a profit sharing. So the ransomware is free. It's a software as a service sort of thing. And a lot of times you'll see like a 70-30 split, meaning the people that actually send the emails and perform the attacks get 70% of the profit. The developer who runs the backend stuff gets 30%. It's ransomware as a service. It's very lucrative for the people sending the attacks. The developer can now focus on developing things and making new and better ransomware, which we keep seeing. So all of these things are very professionalized, like I said before. We see a lot of... Go ahead.
Which school do you have to go to become one of the bad guys? It's a joke.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's kind of funny because, you know, we're all kind of tempted by that at some point in time. We're like, you know, I really know how this works, and it would be really nice just to, retire in the Bahamas or something. But, you know, we have morals, we have ethics. If we have a CISSP, we'd put that at risk, right? But, you know, you look at this, and honestly, when you think about the people in a lot of these countries, they're recruited because we have a lot of very intelligent people, like in Eastern Europe. But the opportunities for them are not there. We see it in India as well. Very intelligent people. They've done a lot of education, but the opportunities aren't there. So these folks, they'll actually come in. There was a guy named Momfa or Hush Puppy who just got busted not too long ago with business email compromise attacks. And he used to recruit people by saying, if you've ever felt like you've been held back and, you know, if you're tired of people taking advantage of you, I'm here to help you lift your way out of this. And it's got pictures of him in front of his Bentley and stuff like that. They play those games to get people involved. And, you know, it's really hard to break that because they don't really have any other options legally in a lot of these countries to take advantage of that. So this is another one I want to talk about because these kind of attacks happen and they start so simple. A lot of people underestimate this. This is a wire transfer fraud attack. And it starts off on the bottom, reads bottom up like most emails, but it's supposedly from the CEO. And it basically goes to the COO in this case. And all it says is, are you in the office? So if you get that email, are you automatically going to think this is a scam, right? You're the COO. You get something from the CEO. It says, hey, are you in the office? No. You know, yeah. Okay. So you reply to that, not thinking anything's off. Well, then it turns around, and sometimes I've seen these get really aggressive. So this one is just, I need a payment process, hit their account today, code it to admin. But I've seen them get really aggressive too. I've seen this target like accounting or even personal assistance. And it starts off with, are you in the office? Or did you get my previous message? This is another powerful one. And when the person replies back and says, no, sir or ma'am, I'm sorry, I didn't get your earlier message, the reply to that can get really, really aggressive. And a lot of times it's something like, I sent you an email earlier. I'm trying to work on this acquisition. It's very hush hush. Can't talk to anyone about it. I need you to wire this money. I told them they would already have it. I can't believe you missed this email, sort of thing. And they get super aggressive on the person. And the person is, of course, scared. They're like, oh my gosh, I messed up for the CEO. And so what do? They wire the money off and boom, come to find out it's not real. These sorts of attacks, again, are all emotional. They get them upset. They get them afraid they're going to lose their jobs. And then the critical thinking part, the part where we're questioning what's happening, like this has never happened before. I've never heard anything about an acquisition. We tend to bypass that because we're in this this state of emotional upheaval. And so this is a really powerful way to do that. But you see the simplicity of this here. Are you in the office is how it starts. Or did you get my previous email? So this is another social engineering tactic that's incredibly powerful. Now, social engineering happens in physical situations too. There's some videos out there that show some guys, they walked around in the high-vis vest, like the reflective vest like construction workers use with a ladder. And they just went walking into like movie theaters and everywhere else. Nobody ever questioned them. You know, they've got a hard hat and a high-vis vest and a ladder. Nobody questions where they go. That's physical stuff. And that's because people assume that you're there for a reason. And it's like the tricks. If you're in an organization where you have two sets of doors, an inner door and an outer door, and this is common in places where it rains or snows quite a bit, the outer door is oftentimes open. The inner door is protected by, say, a badge, right? So if you time it so that you hold the door, the outside door for a person, and they scoot in, then if you just show them what looks like a legitimate badge, they feel obligated now to reciprocate you opening the door for them. So they'll hit theirs, they'll open the door and let you in, right? That's a reciprocal nature that humans have. And, you know, all you got to do is show them that you have a badge like it's legit. You don't even have to scan it at that point. That's another way to take advantage of that in physical situations. So it's very, very interesting. Now, the trick is, how do we defend organizations? It's got to be in layers. We need to teach people about these scams that go on. I love anytime we can teach people. It's why I work where I work, honestly. Processes and procedures have to be in place. For example, before you transfer a large amount of money or send out a significant amount of personal information like W-2 forms via an email request, you pick up the phone, call that person, whether it's a CEO or whatever, on a known good number and just say, "Sir or ma'am, wanted to confirm that email is from you." That policy right there would stop probably 50 to 75% of all of the wire transfer frauds that happen. So don't underestimate those as you're looking in your security careers. The processes and the procedures and the policies. Now, they have to be driven from top because the CEO has to be willing to get that call and say, "Yeah, that's me." And you got to design it so that it's not prohibitive, right? So, "Sir, ma'am, you requested $500 be sent, and I'm confirming that." The call you made just might cost the company more of their time than it's worth. So you have to make sure it's at a reasonable amount. But those sorts of processes and procedures are key. Having the email and spam filters. You know, I mentioned Google was blocking 100 million per day. That gets a lot of them, but a ton of them still get through. So most spam filters, we still see about 90 to 95% blocking, but the sheer volume is so high, that's why you still get them. I'm pretty sure everyone on this call right now has had some sort of, you know, spam emails getting through or scam stuff. They just can't stop at all. And the more focus they get using the open source intelligence I talked about earlier, the more focus they get, the more likely it is to buzz right through those. But it's important to have them on there. Endpoint protection, that's your antivirus. There are some people that say that antivirus is dead. You don't need to use it. I'm not one of them. It's very much like the Hail Mary these days. If all else fails, let's hope the endpoint protection catches it. And some of the endpoint protection is pretty darn good. They use heuristics or user behavior analysis. For example, with the ransomware side of things, let's say Bob in accounting never encrypts files, and then all of a sudden he's encrypting files 300 per minute. The endpoint protection should go, "Wow, that's a really odd thing for him to do," and stop that process. And that would be an example of where ransomware would start doing something like that. Not everything is like that. Not every antivirus or endpoint protection is created the same. I'm a big fan of, again, heuristics. Things like the CrowdStrike Falcon product I really like. And no, they're not paying me to say any of this. But there's a lot of those out there that actually do that. I like Sophos for Home, actually. Sophos XG is free for home users. And it has some pretty good stuff. I tend to test it on occasion. And it does pretty darn well. And then last but not least these days, data loss prevention, or DLP, is a must have. We see over and over again where organizations are getting hit either with data breaches, transferring data out, social engineering attacks like W-2 fraud, which we see often in the first quarter of the year. They basically call up and say, "Send me," or email and say, "Send me your all the employees' W-2s. I need to look at them, you know, pretending to be the boss. They do that. Social security numbers are out there. We need to be watching for things as they leave our network as well as what comes in. So data loss prevention is key. And in the ransomware world that we live in right now, like Carnival Cruise Lines just announced that they were a victim of ransomware, but the new ransomware is exfiltrating data first. So they have a breach on their hands, not just having to restore the files, but an unknown amount of user stuff has gone out the door. They just came up through their SEC filing that they just did. But this is not uncommon. You know, starting in, let's see, fourth quarter of last year with May's ransomware, we're seeing data being pulled out. And if you remember the story, there was a law firm in New York that handled a lot of celebrities out of California. They had 750 gigs of celebrity information leave their network and nobody noticed. Okay. We've got to get better at that side of things. So we have to have these layers. Now, one of the things, and one of the reasons I work where I do, and I do the talks that I do quite a bit, is as geeks, many of us are, right? If we're in security, a lot of us tend to be geeks. We like technology. I've never been more happy than in a server room with fans buzzing and nobody bothering me, right? We tend to gravitate towards technical solutions. And that's a problem. We don't want to take on the user training and education piece. So I do want to talk about that, because as you move on with your careers, understand this is actually a very important part of your security plan, but it's one that tends to get overlooked the most often. So we do well with technology. The key is we need to make this stuff relevant for the people that we're training. I know that in my history, doing training classes was obviously, I tend to get excited by technical things. So I'll jump down the technical rabbit holes, and the people in accounting are over there, you know, nodding off or drooling on their desks. So we have to do it that's a little bit more interesting to people, if you will. If you're not comfortable training people, get someone else in another department that is good at that sort of thing to help. And so what I recommend people do is get the HR department involved or marketing. They live in a world where they're changing human behavior and they're making people get interest. Have them do that. Don't forget to include those groups. At the very least, put what you're going to put out in front of the organization in front of them and say, hey, how does this look to you? What does this look like? And let them tell you, did it get too technical? I mean, one of the smartest people I know when I was at ISC Squared was doing a course, and he was demonstrating what's called a Wi-Fi pineapple, if you know what that is. It's a little device that you basically fire up. It's a $99 deal, and it's designed to intercept Wi-Fi, so to get in the middle of Wi-Fi signals. And he's teaching all of these people that are in marketing, that are in all these other departments, and he's getting into packet capturers, and he's showing all of this, like, check it out. And if we look at this and we look at this, I was ready to throw myself out the window, and I'm a technical guy, right? So we have to be careful what it is that we're doing when we're trying to train these people. We also don't want to just do it once a year, because people are not going to remember. It has to be throughout the year. I like doing little bite-sized things that are relevant to the times. Again, one of these things, we know that fourth quarter, there's going to be scams around the holidays. Why not throw a few things out there and tell people, hey, watch out for this sort of thing coming up. It's relevant. It matters. It'll help them personally. First quarter, there's tax scams galore. So let's make sure they understand that. Make it relevant like that. That's kind of what I'm talking. And maybe 5-10 minute sort of training, not the really long, boring stuff. And just remember, yeah, that technical people think differently than non-technical. And finally, don't try to change too much at a time. That's a big thing that I see people mess up on is, you know, we come into an organization, we want to kick the door wide open and we want to change everything. And that usually ends absolutely horrible. And then we sit there with a turtle on our head. It's no, but you know, we tend to set ourselves up for failure when we try to go too much too fast. So pick a couple of things, try to change that, and then go from there. So that being said, I'm going to end the slides here, and let's let's have some questions. Let's have some, you know, if you got questions about this, I'm happy to answer them. Whatever else I can do to help. And I'm talking not just this, but, you know, careers in general. Go ahead, Laurent.
Eric, thank you for speaking to us. What I'd like you to do, sorry for interrupting you. What I'd like you to do is talk briefly about CISSP. You have a unique vision because, one, you are CISSP and you are even CISSP-ISSAP, which is the advanced architectural concentration of CISSP. You're a former reviewer.
Oh, I think we lost you, Laurent. You back?
Right?
We lost you there for a second.
Okay, sorry. So you reviewed questions for ISC Square like me, and you were ISC Square person. What can you say to our students about why they should do ISC Square, the benefit of CISSP? Can you speak to that, the benefit of CISSP?
Certainly. The CISSP is a very good certification to have. Honestly, the best thing about the CISSP is it takes the gatekeeping done in the community by the recruiters and by organizations and basically just steamrolls it. If you have a CISSP, that's going to open up most of those doors. It's absolutely fantastic for that. It also, there's a couple of things with the CISSP that are different from other certs, like you have to agree to ethics. You can have your CISSP stripped for doing something unethical. And I actually sat on the ethics board at ISC Squared where we reviewed things like that. And it was very interesting to see how that works. So they take that very, very seriously. If a fellow CISSP files a complaint and says, so-and-so did this and this is unethical behavior, they will go through and they will follow up and look into it. They'll research it and then basically have a hearing on it. Now, the CISSP is different from a lot of other certifications in security in that the old saying is it's a mile wide and an inch deep. So it covers all kinds of topics. Now, that's actually a good thing. And I know that if I'm looking to hire someone that's a CISSP, it tells me that they've been exposed to things in all of these different areas. Like, for example, in my case, I've never done application security. That's not my thing. But in order to pass the CISSP, I at least had to have a basic knowledge of how that worked, which I might not have even gotten had I not had to take that exam, right? So it's very good in that it exposes you to things that in your day-to-day job, you may never see. We did joke about things, you know, there used to be questions on there about, you know, where to put lights outside for physical security to cover the most area and how much area they would carry and, you know, how high a bollard should be. I don't think it's quite that way anymore. And Laurent's right. You know, we used to write some questions for this too, and it was very interesting to see the process. This cert, unlike many, many other ones, you will never see a real brain dump on where you can just memorize the questions and answers because they roll through them so quickly. It's really a big deal. Now, I will say that the CISSP has absolutely helped me in my career more times than I can count. So I do recommend it. It's probably the hardest test I've ever taken. And I'll never forget when I took my CISSP, we had it on paper booklets. Okay. And we had to fill in little bubbles. Remember those ABC like bubble things, the Scantron sheets. And I remember they gave it to us. We were in a room with a bunch of people and proctors watching over. And I opened it up and I read the first question on there and I closed the book and made sure it was a CISSP. Cause I was like, I have no idea what this is asking me. Somehow or another, by the grace of God, I passed that test. And I promised myself I would never do another ISC Squared exam again. And it wasn't but about a year and a half later that I'm sitting for this ISSAP that Laurent mentioned, which is a deep dive into security architecture. And I remember sitting there too, and what was I thinking? Why did I do this? It is a good test because it does involve a lot of thinking. And honestly, you will reach a part in your career where in many cases, not all, but in many cases, this is going to be a difference between getting through the HR portion and not, kind of like a degree.
Don't you think that many people, it's a little brutal what I'm going to say, but you know, there's the CISSPs and then there's everybody else. I mean, you may consider, you know, some people that are famous, you like Kevin, doesn't matter whether he's CISSP or what.
Well, he can't get one anyways because of his conviction.
Well, yeah. But otherwise, you're going to look at, is the person CISSP? And then there's everybody else. Do you feel like that too?
I do. I'll be honest. I wish it wasn't that way.
Me too.
I do wish people were judged just on their merits or had a better way to do that. Unfortunately, the world that we're in right now, that is honestly the truth. And again, the recruiters, they put that up there and sometimes they have no idea what they're asking for. You know, these recruiters, if you think about it, in organizations, they may hire 100 salespeople per year and one security guy or gal. So what do? They try to go out and they pull from somewhere else that they see something that looks like a similar job and they adjust that because a lot of times they don't know what they're actually looking for. And they see that, well, CISSP seems to be the thing. And so they plan it on that. And that's where sometimes you get these, entry level positions, junior security analyst, 2 years experience required and a CISSP, which requires 5 years of experience. Unfortunately, it is the world we are in. There are people that are vehemently opposed to the CISSP and they kind of froth at the mouth a little bit. What you'll find a lot of times is those are the people that have honestly taken the test 2 or 3 times and they just don't pass it. Now, you remember, Laurent, when we were at the CTNOSC, we had a big push for people getting certified. This is when DOD rolled out the 8570. And some of the smartest people I knew, they were technically brilliant, failed that test 3 or 4 times.
Remember
and the reason, yes.
Travon, 6 times. And then
right. Yeah,
and
I mean,
smart kid.
Yeah, very, very smart people. But they were trying to apply technical solutions a lot of times to what is not always a technical problem. And that's one thing that the exam is really good at, is separating that sort of stuff out.
So again, as I've been telling you guys, think like a manager always. It's never the technical answer. If you have a choice, it's always the managerial answer, okay? And remember, it's not about knowing all of the answers. It's about being better at eliminating 2 bad answers and guessing the least worst option of the 2, okay? It's not about knowing. Lots of people, I mean, I had in IT 277 this year, a number of my students were saying, what's the correct answer? And I'm like, what do you think is the correct answer and why? It's academia. You need to prove it, academy, scholastic-wise, prove your answer. What is the answer? And then ISC square, it could be different ways. It's why there's not always 2 answers. And you've been in boards. Can you confirm to the students that, you know, it's potentially very, there's potentially very hot debates on some questions. I remember a question about Bell LaPadula model, and I explained to people that a person is not top secret. Otherwise, the person stays in Area 51 forever. It's information that is top secret. And no one but me understood that. And students in the class don't understand either that sometimes the answer is, it's not very clear. And there is this element of doubt where you need to understand the philosophy and not worry whether you answer right or wrong. If you worry about this, you're not going to do good. Can you elaborate on this a little?
Yeah, the other thing, I mean, that you really need to look at is, this is an exam done for international people, okay? So one thing that I learned, I used to joke all the time before I got involved in item writing, but I thought, you know, it was a bunch of drunk monkeys got together and wrote some of these questions because you're just like, oh my gosh, you know? But once I got involved in it, I saw the process, and the process was pretty brutal. So to explain the way it worked, I would – well, they would say, we need some questions in this area or this area. And then we would go back and we would say, okay, we'll take these, I'll take these. And you come up with these great questions. And you come up with the distractors, which are the ones that are the wrong answers, and then the key, which is the right answer. So then you bring this all back to the table, and at the end of the day, everybody reviews what you've written. Now, by review it, I mean, sometimes there were some very heated discussions, like almost chair throwing WWE style discussions. But people, you know, it humbled me a lot because I remember, I don't remember the question, but I remember there was a situation where I posed a question and I thought it was very correct. But a gentleman named Dimitri, I think, he popped up and said, you know, in my country, this is not correct because X, Y, Z. And I was having the very American thought process of it. We have to understand that there are bigger things than that when it comes to making the questions or the answers correct or not correct. So I had to rephrase things to make sure that it was very clear what I was talking about in the context.
And just to remind students something that I mentioned to them when I talk about the exam, I actually had a question written in Chinese or Japanese in my exam back when it was paper, and the 6-hour exam was a question in either Chinese or Japanese. The question and the answer, you cannot let it, nothing can bother you when you take the exam. Otherwise, you're just going to fail. You need to be prepared for an earthquake. You need to be prepared for noise in the room, to be stomach sick or whatever. Be ready for the unexpected, and then, you know that potentially at the end of the exam, you're not going to even remember where your car is parked because you will be drained. I mean, I left my exam and I was like, what am I doing? I mean, where's my car? I mean, did you have such experience, Eric?
Yeah, you know, I left the exam. I actually went to one of the little, like, I think it was a Los Betos or something. It was a Mexican food restaurant there in Sierra Vista. And I got a burrito and pretty much stared at the wall for the next half hour. I was so mentally exhausted by it. And Dr. Burton, to your point there with the SMEs not being able to agree, the rest of the process is when they would tear this apart, then you would go back and you would fix the question. This was actually part of the QA and QC process. So you would go back and you would rewrite it, and then you would put it in front of this group again of 10 to 15 international people. And it would never be allowed to pass and actually go into the live database of questions until it was actually approved by everybody in the room and it met those requirements. So eventually, yes, it did work. But it's a very interesting process. But yeah, to your point, Laurent, I was so mentally exhausted and I had still an hour and change drive ahead of me, afterwards. And I knew I just literally went and stared at the wall for a little while at a nice little restaurant until I could get enough brains back to drive home. It is mentally exhausting. The new one though, they're doing it electronically now. And the good news is it's adaptive. So they may start out with a really hard question in an area. And if you answer that one correctly, they figure you know your stuff and they may not ask you anymore in that area. So I've seen people end up passing it like right around the 100 something, low 100 scores of questions. And it's because they were able to do that. So they didn't have to get subjected to 250 of these horrible, horrible questions. So definitely a positive in how they did that.
150, no. It's maximum 150.
Yeah, okay.
The new exam.
Yeah.
To answer to what Tina said, the exams are set up, if I remember correctly, so that 70% of the people answer correctly and answer. So a CISSP, as long as on average they answer 70% correctly, you're good to go. So. Yeah. There's never going to be everybody agree on every single question. It's why if you worry about the right answer, you are thinking like an engineer, not like a CISSP. CISSP, the answer is it depends. It depends on the circumstance. It depends on the question. It depends on a bunch of stuff. There's no correct answer.
And there's a role that I had no idea existed until I went to work for ISC Squared. It's called a psychometrician, which is a really cool title, right? But these are people that actually do the math behind exams like this. Very intelligent people. So they look at the patterns. In the CISSP, there's generally some questions that are not going to count against your score. They are test questions that they will roll in there and see how they do. So if, let's say, 85% of the people that pass the exam fail one of those questions, they know there's something wrong with that question, and it will no longer, it won't go out in the real scoring side of things, if that makes sense. So these psychometricians are looking at this, they're balancing, some questions are worth more than others. It's honestly, in the back end of all that, it's black magic. It really is. But it all seems to work.
Cool.
But that's good science to be able to do that. I mean, I wish we could throw stuff out and see how it goes before we release it. But, you know, they have the ability to just throw questions in there and see how they fly.
Yeah, it really is. And it's one of the things that impresses me about that exam. It's one of the reasons the exam costs so much versus, say, a Security Plus, right? There is so much maintenance involved and so much, there's so much behind it that most people never see or consider. To include the team of psychometricians and the groups like that. It's really an impressive thing when you kind of see behind the scenes a little bit.
Do you also agree that they're kind of managing the pass rate and making sure it doesn't get any higher than whatever it is, which they don't tell you?
I think what they, at least when I was there, now I've been away for a few years. And so the group that I worked with, their goal was not to manage the pass rate per se. It was to manage the difficulty of the test and make sure that every iteration was equally as difficult as the next one, because you're floating in different questions from different ways and different scales. And so they were really, really focused on that. Now, I've been away for a couple of years. I don't know if that's changed. I know the teams that did that changed a little bit, but they were really focused on ensuring that if I take the test today and you take it in 4 weeks, your version isn't that much harder than mine, or vice versa.
Right.
Yeah, because technology changes, there's topics that change. So they're trying to adjust. And again, keep probably around a 70% pass rate altogether on question. On any question, roughly 70% of people need to pass. If a question is not answered by 70% of the question, then they start questioning it.
That's where the psychometricians really start looking at it. If it's 100% or if it's 40%, they're going to start looking at those very closely, and they may just toss them out and have them rewritten or toss them out altogether.
And one thing that people need to keep in mind, as I said during the class, is that as Eric said, you know, him and I have sat on review boards for ISC Square. There's typically 3 or 4 English-speaking people. Everybody else is from Japan, which of course speaks English fluently, or Germany, which again speaks English fluently, or Italy, or Norway, or other countries. And the result is that sometimes the questions don't make any sense. And you need to accept that the question sometimes, you need to think, what could it mean? And you need to, you cannot let anything bug you. And it's why when I have students that tell me, okay, but what's the correct answer? It's not the right philosophy. You need to understand, why could this one be the right answer? What's the justification for the other 3 answers being wrong? This is the right philosophy. You know, I'm struggling with this. And, you know, I'd like you, Eric, to just tell the students very clearly, don't worry about what's right. Worry about why it's right and why the rest is wrong. Can you say yes or no, Eric? Please say yes.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely want to examine. Usually 2 of the distractors are going to be very wrong, and you can eliminate those pretty quickly. It's usually between 2 of them. So you have to think again around some corners on that. And what would make this right? What would make this wrong or more right? And then if it all falls apart, you know, we can take the military way, which is when in doubt, Charlie out and just block C and move on. You know, the other thing is when you test on this in a serious note, if you can't make up your mind, go with your gut. Our gut feeling is correct more often than we give it credit for. And do not go back and change things unless you have a really good reason to change your questions there.
Rick, you cannot go back anymore.
Yeah. I don't think you can. Huh?
I wasn't sure if you could tag them and review before submitting anymore, but that's one of those things. Just go with your gut on those and, answer the question and move on. Don't think about it anymore, because that'll get inside your head and continue to wear you down too. Many times this is a mental fatigue game as much as anything else.
Okay. Eric,
this was great.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Keep that. Hope we don't have to wait 3 more years until we meet back at DEF CON.
No kidding.
Tina, would you like to conclude?
Yep. Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today. I thought it was very entertaining as well as informative, so I appreciate that. It looks like the students had a great time. I'm going to post or send the recording for everybody, and actually what it happens is it posts to the invite, so everybody has that. But are you okay with us sharing the slides or no?
Absolutely. I can get you a copy of those if you'd like. Okay. I'll get you a PDF version, though, because if you see my speaker notes, you'll have no idea what I'm talking about.
That would be perfect. That's people. I can send that out with the recording tomorrow. So I totally appreciate your time. Hopefully we can have you come back at another time. And I think it was very informative for everybody.
Yep. Well, thank you all. I really do appreciate it.
Awesome. All right, everyone. Have a great evening. Thank you so much. Bye. Talk to you soon.